The Virginia Dynasty, Part 2, The Monroe Administration. James Monroe was sworn in as the fifth president of the United States under the current federal constitution in March of 1817. And within a very short time, he had a serious crisis on his hands. The commander of the American army in the southeastern part of the country, Andrew Jackson, was, of course, the famous victor of the Battle of New Orleans. He was under instructions to parry raids from Spanish Florida into American territory. What had been happening is that Indians and escaped slaves living in the northern part of Spanish Florida, which included not only today's state of Florida, but the coastal regions of Alabama and Mississippi, as well as of Louisiana east of the Mississippi River, had been crossing over into American territory. Once they got into American territory, they had been burning farmsteads, seizing people's property, freeing slaves, in some cases even killing American citizens. And so Jackson was under orders to force these people back into Florida. In fact, if it were possible, he was to pursue them into Florida and kill them. But he was also under strict instructions from his immediate civilian superior, Secretary of War John C. Calhoun, not to invade Florida. Jackson was not to invade Florida and certainly not to conquer it. However, one day in 1817, he did exactly what he'd been instructed not to do. And so there came to be a serious dispute in the Monroe cabinet over what to do about this. After all, this insubordination on the part of a conquering general was exactly the threat of militarism that Republicans in the United States, using lowercase r, people who were interested in Republican government in the United States, had been worried about all the way back to the Revolution and even before the Revolution. The idea was that people with big armies at their backs and lots of popularity from winning military victories might overthrow Republican government. Certainly that's what Thomas Jefferson saw in incipient form in Andrew Jackson, and that's why Jefferson, for one, was very unhappy at the prospect of Andrew Jackson's political popularity. Anyway, when they had the debate over the question how to respond to Jackson's actions in the Monroe cabinet, Secretary of War Calhoun advised President Monroe to relieve Jackson of his command. And that's military ease for to fire him. And this seems to have been the consensus among Monroe's civilian advisors. In fact, it's likely that Monroe was leaning that direction himself. But Secretary of State John Quincy Adams was the exception to this general rule. Adams usually judged, although a failed president, to have been the most successful Secretary of State in American history. And we can see his genius in the advice he gave to President Monroe at this point. Adams, of course, conceded that insubordination on the part of military officers was definitely to be dreaded. But he said, we can take advantage of what Jackson has done here. If we were to relieve him, we couldn't. But if we don't relieve him, we can. And what he told Monroe ought to happen is what actually did happen. Jackson wrote a letter to the King of Spain. In the letter, he made clear that Adams wrote a letter to the King of Spain. And in the letter, he made clear that Jackson had not been under orders to invade Florida. However, Adams also made clear that the ease with which Jackson had conquered Florida made obvious to anyone who was looking that the Americans could do so again at any time. And so he asked the King of Spain, wouldn't you like us to pay you for Florida? The implication being that otherwise we could take it for free. Well, the King of Spain didn't much like being shaken down, and so he appealed to other major crowned heads in Europe, asking them whether they were going to let the upstart Americans behave this way. When nobody else came to Spain's aid, ultimately the Spanish king reluctantly agreed to sell the United States Florida, not only today's state, but that other Gulf Coast territory as well. And that's how Florida came to be part of the United States. The second major development of the Monroe administration is what people at the time and historians since have denominated the Missouri Crisis. What happened here was that Missouri, which was a little sliver of land in the gigantic Louisiana Territory purchased by the Jefferson administration from France in 1803, Missouri applied for statehood. That is, there had come to be sufficient American population in Missouri that the people who lived there had drafted their own constitution and had applied for membership in the Federal Union. Nobody thought this would be really any kind of a controversy at all, and in fact, the Speaker of the House, Henry Clay from Kentucky, scheduled a hearing on the question of Missouri statehood in a pretty insignificant committee, and he didn't think it would take much time, and ultimately what happened was that an unknown Republican congressman from New York threw a spanner in the works. He proposed that two amendments be added to the bill for Missouri statehood. The first one, according to this fellow, Congressman Talmadge, was that importation of slaves into Missouri should cease immediately. Secondly, he said, there should be a gradual emancipation provision in the bill providing for Missouri statehood. This provision, like the gradual emancipation acts adopted by several of the original states, would put a date certain at the end of new slavery in Missouri. That is, would provide that after a certain date, people who were slaves in Missouri would be free. So what had been thought to be a relatively routine matter became a consuming controversy in Washington for almost 2 years. People divided over the question of what to do about Missouri. And here, the division was not over partisan political allegiance, but essentially geographic. Ultimately, the problem was worked out with a program of three what are called compromise bills in a supposed Missouri compromise that were proposed by Speaker of the House Henry Clay. But in the interim, there had been a lot of there had been the development of a feeling, a new kind of feeling of northern or southern sectional identity. And we can find a lot of this sentiment expressed in the correspondence of former Presidents Jefferson and Madison. Jefferson, for his part, was extremely upset over the Missouri controversy. In fact, in one extremely famous letter, Jefferson wrote that the news of the Missouri crisis came to me as a fire bell in the night, tolling the knell of the Union. Nowadays, the dramatic impact of these images may be lost on us because we don't worry much about fires and we don't hear knells. But if we lived in the early part of the 19th century, fire would be a great fear of ours. In fact, fire in urban areas was a terrible threat. In 1666, virtually the entire city of London burned down in what's called the Great London Fire. And then, of course, late in the 19th century, the city of Chicago in the United States was burned nearly entirely as well. So when Jefferson said that the Missouri controversy came to him as a fire bell in the night, this meant that it struck fear in his heart. Now, a knell, he said it was tolling the knell of the Union. A knell was a particular pattern of bell ringing that one heard from a church when there was a funeral. And again, nowadays we don't often hear church bells. But when Jefferson was writing this, if you lived in a town, you heard church bells on a regular basis. They had a particular pattern they rang to call people to services, particular pattern that was a celebratory pattern to say at the end of a wedding. And if you had a funeral, well, then you'd have a knell, K-N-E-L-L. So Jefferson was saying this is an awful thing. It's a threat to the Union. He also, Jefferson, took a position that was pro-Missouri. That is, he thought that people who lived in Missouri should be admitted to the Union with the state constitution they had adopted. And the way he explained this to one northern correspondent was, well, you in Massachusetts have decided for yourselves whether you'd have slavery, and we in Virginia have decided for ourselves whether we'd have slavery. If Missourians are made to submit to some policy mandate from Congress on this issue of slavery, then Missouri will be, de facto, a subordinate class of state. Well, it's been the policy of the United States from the very beginning, as captured, for example, in the Northwest Ordinance, under which the Northwest Cession that Virginia had made in 1791 was carved up into separate states, it had been the policy of the United States from the beginning that there would be only one class of state, that all the new states would have the same rights as the original states. So there wouldn't be higher taxes in one group of states than in another, federal taxes. There wouldn't be a lower portion of population in new states than in old, and so on. So Jefferson said, this is just an unacceptable violation of our principle that we'll only have one class of states. To people who lived in Virginia, Jefferson wrote, if Congress will not admit you to the Union with the Constitution that you have drafted, you are independent, and we will support you. Notice, you are independent. Not, you can declare your independence, you can make yourselves independent, you should ask Congress whether you can be independent, just you are independent. And this says something about the way that Jefferson understood the federal relationship. For Jefferson, the basic unit of political identification and political organization in the United States were the states. So he was primarily a Virginian, and somebody who lived in Missouri owed his primary allegiance to the state of Missouri. And when did that state come into existence? It came into existence when the people who lived there drafted and adopted a constitution. It didn't require some outside group's consent for that constitution to be valid. So it didn't require Congress to approve it for Missouri's constitution to be valid among Missourians. Now, if people in the Congress didn't want to admit Missouri to the Union in which the other states were members, they had the right not to let Missouri do that. But Jefferson said, well, at that point, you're a separate state. If they won't let you into the Congress, then you're just on your own footing and we'll support you. Jefferson actually was extremely upset by these developments. And in fact, one scholar has recently written a book about Jefferson's nationalism in which he says that he thinks that Jefferson was nearly suicidal at the end of his life. He was so struck by the difference between the way that people in Congress seemed to understand the American Revolution's legacy and the way he understood it. For Jefferson, the Revolution had been primarily about establishing local self-government. And here it seemed that Congress wanted to deprive the people in Missouri of that. So he said, actually, in one famous letter that he was sorry to see that it seemed the sons of the Revolution were squandering the legacy their fathers had won for them. Jefferson then was very unhappy about the Missouri crisis, and he wasn't alone. Former President Madison thought this was threatening virtually to the same extent as did Jefferson. And then Madison wrote, to a northern friend, look, we have had political party conflicts in the United States. We've had two parties, and they could contest various issues of tariffs and internal improvements and our attitude toward the French revolutionaries and all these kinds of things. And so although the parties were stronger in some states and weaker in others, so for example, there were more Federalists than Republicans in Massachusetts, and there were more Republicans than Federalists in Virginia, still we had two-party conflict. On the other hand, we could compromise. On the other hand, he said, if you draw a line on a map and you say that people on one side of this line are going to stand for one principle and people on the other side are going to stand for the opposite principle, there's no compromising that. How can you compromise that? He said the end of it must be the breakup of the Union. So as far as he was concerned, what was essential at this point was to work through this issue, to get the debate over with. Ultimately, Henry Clay's so-called compromise measures were passed out of Congress. Now, I say so-called compromise measures. At the time, Clay described them as compromise measures, and historians commonly say the Missouri Compromise was the end of this conflict. But as historian Michael Holt of the University of Virginia, the expert in 19th century federal politics, has shown, if you look at the roll call votes in the House and Senate, what you see is that there really wasn't much of anybody who was compromising. That is, Clay proposed three measures. The first one would admit Missouri to the Union with the Constitution that the Missourians had adopted. The second one would admit Maine District of Massachusetts, that is today's state of Maine, which always had been part of Massachusetts, to the Union with a Constitution that banned slavery. And then the third provision was a geographic one. It would draw a line across the Louisiana Purchase Territory extending west from Virginia's, from Missouri's southern boundary at 36 degrees 30 minutes latitude. So you draw a line there, and then the Clay proposal says, north of that line, we will admit no more states with slavery. So Missouri would be the only Louisiana Territory state north of 3630 with slavery. Well, what happened eventually in the Congress is when they voted on Maine admission, basically Northerners voted for it. When they voted on Missouri admission, mainly Southerners voted for it. When they voted on the 36 degree 30 minute line, they had mainly Northerners and some Southerners, actually fewer than voted for the Missouri admission, vote for that. So who was compromising? Not much of anyone. Why would people take the positions they took? On the Southern side, one reason was this constitutional position that I've outlined Jefferson having adopted. But another reason was that the people who lived in Missouri, for the most part, were Southerners, and they had taken slaves with them out there. In fact, as it happened, a lot of them were from Virginia, including even people from Jefferson's own family circle. In fact, some of his own relatives lived there. So one of the first judges in the Missouri Territory was a fellow named Nathaniel Beverly Tucker, whose father was a fellow professor, St. George Tucker, who was also a Virginia judge, and who had been the second law professor at the College of William and Mary, Jefferson's alma mater. And besides that, Nathaniel Beverly Tucker was the stepbrother of Jefferson's cousin, John Randolph of Roanoke, the House Majority Leader at the beginning of Jefferson's presidential administration. So people like Tucker migrating to Missouri, being from Virginia, had taken slaves with them. Why had there been such a large proportion of the population of Missouri that was from Virginia? Well, the answer is Virginia and Missouri are basically on the same line of latitude. They're more or less at the same latitude. And so it was, you know, predictable that these people would move out there and they would take their economic organization and their social structure out there with them. On the other hand, Northerners argued that slavery should be kept out of this Missouri territory because the American Revolution, they said, was devoted to the idea of the end of slavery. So remember, Jefferson said that the American Revolution had been preponderantly about this idea of local self-government through elections. And people like Talmadge argued, no, the people who made the American Revolution hoped that slavery was going to come to an end. They banned it in several northern states. Through the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, they banned it from the Old Northwest, that is Virginia's Northwest Session, and so it should not be allowed to move into Missouri either. Well, ultimately, these three bills from Clay came out of Congress and were sent to President Monroe. You might think, well, it's not going to be hard for Monroe to resolve this question. Monroe was, of course, a Virginia slave owner. He was not so fabulously wealthy on a princely scale as Jefferson. He was not so gigantically wealthy as Madison, but he was kind of a rung further down the ladder than they were, and a very comfortable slave-owning Virginia lawyer and politician, soldier, and so on. And actually in Virginia, most people, the overwhelming majority of white people, that is voters, were opposed to the Missouri Compromise, as it's called. On the other hand, besides hearing from them, Monroe also heard from his chief advisor, the fellow from whom he was most prone to take advice on domestic policy was his war secretary, John C. Calhoun, a very, very intelligent man who was a devout, devoted young Republican official. And Calhoun told Monroe something much like what Madison was saying in his private correspondence. That is, the most important thing about this controversy is to end the controversy. We want to preserve the Union. It's essential, as General Washington said in his farewell address. And so the main thing we have to do is just put this argument behind us. With that in mind, Monroe signed the three bills that had come to him as a package from the House and Senate, and the Missouri controversy, one might have thought, was over. Actually, it was kind of to come back in the following year when Missouri adopted a new law that said no free blacks could move into Missouri. You might think, well, that's peculiarly racist, right? Who would adopt such a policy? And it's true that this obviously was a racist policy, but we shouldn't think that there was anything unique about Missouri in adopting this policy. Ultimately, there would be a similar law in Illinois in the middle of the 19th century. And when Oregon was admitted to statehood, again in the middle of the 19th century, the state constitution of Oregon said that no free blacks could move into, no blacks could move into Oregon. This provision of the state constitution remained in the Oregon Constitution until about the year 2000, amazingly. Of course, it hadn't been enforced in a very long time by then. But the same way of thinking about these questions had purchase on people beyond Missouri and beyond the South. Another important question that we associate, another important issue that we associate with the Monroe administration is what's called the Monroe Doctrine. And what happened here was that in the Monroe years, there was a wave of revolutionary independence agitation in the Spanish colonies south of the United States. So essentially, virtually everything in the mainland, virtually the entire American mainland south of the United States had been Spanish, with the notable exception of Brazil and a couple of other small dots on the map. But essentially, this was Spanish territory. And beginning is more or less at the year 1821, they began, these various regions of the old Spanish Empire began proclaiming their independence. The British did not have any idea of colonizing this territory themselves, but what they wanted to do was to step in and ensure that the new independence would be permanent. So the British Foreign Ministry contacted the Monroe administration with a proposal. The United States and Britain should join in a common proclamation that the two of them would both oppose any attempt by any European country to recolonize any territory in the Western Hemisphere. So both America and Great Britain would oppose militarily any attempt by any European power to establish military dominance of any part of the Western Hemisphere. When this question was debated in the Monroe cabinet, most people, it seems, were in favor of joining the British in this proclamation. One exception, Secretary of State Adams, who once again had a very creative, really ingenious answer in mind, and ultimately this became the policy of the Monroe administration. Adams said, if we join the British in making this proclamation, everybody will realize that we're just the tail on the British lion, right? It'll be mainly the British who are going to be enforcing this policy, and we'll kind of follow along and, you know, hold their trains as they march into the cathedral. On the other hand, we could let the British make this proclamation themselves without us, and we could make our own proclamation to the same effect. Then, in future, we would be free to enforce or not to enforce our proclamation. Someday, it's likely that we're going to have a far more powerful navy and military generally than we do now, and so this will be a useful precedent to have established. And that's what ultimately what President Monroe decided to do. He decided that America should have a separate proclamation of this policy of keeping European powers from recolonizing the Western Hemisphere. A final point to note about the Monroe administration is the way that electoral politics, presidential politics, worked out. By 1820, the Federalist Party was so weak that they didn't even put up a national candidate. That is, they didn't have a presidential nominee. So the Federalist Party had more or less ceased to exist. Notice, however, that the Republican Party was weakening significantly as well, and that's because President Monroe, like Thomas Jefferson, his mentor before him, thought that naturally there was only one party. We're all Americans. In fact, Jefferson had said in his first inaugural address, "We have called by different names brethren of the same principle. We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists." Well, when he came to office, Monroe decided he was going actually to give effect to this notion by not doing anything to keep the Republican political structure alive. He wasn't going to take active support of the Republican Party into account in making appointments to postmasterships and tax collectorships and so on throughout the country. He was not going to try to keep the structure going. And so in 1820, he was reelected president with all but one vote in the Electoral College. And yet his party had more or less withered on the vine as well. Now, in 1824, people could see that there was going to be a new kind of presidential election, and that's because there was going to be a unique feature to the 1824 contest. This was going to be the first contest. Notice it's the 10th presidential election. It would be the first one in which there was not an obvious Virginian candidate for president. So we've had two terms of Washington, one term of Adams, not from Virginia, two terms of Jefferson, two of Madison, two of Monroe. Even when Adams, not from Virginia, was president for one term, his vice president, whom he barely defeated for president, was Thomas Jefferson from Virginia. So in 1824, on the other hand, there's going to be an election in which there's no obvious Virginian candidate. In fact, the fact that there were not two-party politics in the Monroe administration has led some people to refer to this time in American history as the era of good feelings. If there wasn't partisan party contention, it must have been an era of good feelings. That's not exactly the way things looked in Congress, certainly not, for example, during the Missouri crisis. But anyway, in 1824, the five major figures in American politics all decided, okay, here's my chance. Well, we don't have a Virginian. This is my turn. And so the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Treasury, the Secretary of War, the Speaker of the House, and America's most famous outstanding military hero, conquering general, were the five main candidates. The Speaker of the Secretary of State was John Quincy Adams. The Secretary of Treasury, William Crawford from Georgia. Secretary of War, Calhoun from South Carolina. Speaker of the House, Clay, whom I've mentioned before. And, of course, General Jackson, the victor of the Battle of New Orleans and conqueror of Florida. Conqueror of various other Indians besides. We'll come back to that. Anyway, after a while, it became clear to Calhoun that he was not going to get the support of Pennsylvania that he was relying on in his candidacy, and he figured he could get both his own state of South Carolina and Pennsylvania to endorse him, but that failed, and so he decided to withdraw from the presidential campaign. And at that point, the other four candidates all agreed, well, yes, you'd make a great vice president. So that left four candidates. When the popular vote was taken and the electoral votes were tallied, it was clear that the fourth place candidate was the Speaker of the House, Henry Clay. Now, under the original structure of the Constitution, as amended by the 12th Amendment, if nobody gets a majority of the Electoral College votes for president, the top three names are put before the House of Representatives. So here Clay is out, but he is the Speaker of the House. He is then going to have some control over the outcome. In fact, it seems that he had control not only of his home state delegation in the House, that is Kentucky's, but also neighboring Ohio. He had influence in Tennessee, and of course that was Jackson's home state. But anyway, Clay had significant pull in the House. When the top three vote-getters' names went before the House, they did so with everybody knowing that the popular vote plurality and the Electoral College vote plurality had both been won by General Jackson. But after a while of considering the question in the House, the members of Congress came back with not Jackson as the fellow who'd won the election, but John Quincy Adams. And within a few days of that, John Quincy Adams announced that he was going to appoint as Secretary of State Henry Clay. In those days, the appointment to the position of Secretary of State seemed far more important to people than it does now. And the reason is that there was a history of Secretaries of State becoming president, right? So Thomas Jefferson had been Secretary of State, James Madison had been Secretary of State, James Monroe had been Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams had been Secretary of State, and now we have Adams agreeing with Speaker Clay, well, I'll make you Secretary of State. Or at least it seemed to be that he was agreeing. That's what people who supported General Jackson said. They referred to this outcome as the corrupt bargain. Their argument was that despite the will of the people, as proven by the pluralities of popular vote and the Electoral College vote that their man Jackson had won, the coalition of Adams and Clay had decided to make Adams president anyway. And the reason Clay had done this, the story went, was because Adams then turned around and made Clay Secretary of State, which is supposed to be the stepping stone to the presidency. If we look at this neutrally, we can see that really, from Clay's point of view, Adams was the obvious candidate to choose. That is, he was the fellow with whom McClay agreed on virtually every issue. But people at the time didn't see it that way. And you might think, okay, that was political posturing. They called Clay names and Adams names because they wanted to defeat them the next time around and so on. And you might think today that that would be true. And certainly we'd have that kind of suspicion. But we have private correspondence from Calhoun, for example, with his nephew, who was then a member of the low-ranking enlisted man in the army in the West, saying, oh, things are quite a dangerous pass here. I fear for the future of our government, right? There was no reason why Calhoun would write such a letter to his anonymous nephew unless he really believed it. And this idea that there was a corrupt bargain that explained the outcome of the 1824 presidential election would dog Henry Clay through the rest of his career in politics. Clay was an active, very prominent politician all the way down to 1852, and people insisted all the way to that point that he had essentially sold the office of the presidency to John Quincy Adams in 1824.